This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Daily Digest. I'm T. Shao Ik with Lim Soo Ann and Sumitra Selvaraj in the studio. And so now in our second story, we'll be looking at health allocations in Budget 2020, which was, of course, tabled last Friday. So 30.6 billion ringgit was allocated to the Health Ministry. And here's Finance Minister Lim Kuan Eng in his budget speech.
Datuk Yang Pertua, Kerajaan tetap komited bagi memastikan akses kepada penjagaan kesihatan yang berkualiti untuk semua selaras dengan aspirasi masyarakat yang inklusif. Untuk itu, kerajaan akan menyediakan peruntukan bagi meningkatkan langkah pencegahan bertujuan mengurangkan beban perbelanjaan penjagaan kesihatan awam.
So, you know, if you will note there, he said, and I'm translating in English, he said that the allocations are to intensify preventive measurement, preventive measures. So that's an important statement to keep in mind. We'll be returning to this point later in our discussion. But earlier, I spoke to Dr. Kor Swee King, Senior Fellow in Health Systems and Policies from University of Malaya, to get his observations of the budget. So what we'll be doing, we'll be hearing his comments to some of the big ticket items as we go through the list, and we'll be grouping some of the items together for ease of explanation.
Right, so first up, with the we have the 1.9 billion ringgit for construction and upgrading of hospitals, health and dental clinics, as well as living quarters for healthcare staff. There were some specific hospitals and clinics identified, including a few in Sabah and Sarawak. We also saw 381 million ringgit allocated to upgrade medical equipment, infrastructure and facilities. So this includes ambulances.
Hang on, didn't you just say something about 1.9 billion for upgrading hospitals and health and dental clinics? And now we've got 308. I really wish they would make this a little bit clear. I know the budget is just supposed to be an allocation, but you know, this sort of overlapping is exactly what raises questions in people's minds, right?
In terms of how the funding is being dispersed and being spent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And perhaps if there were some examples of how exactly this would have gone through, it would have made a clearer picture as well.
Well, the thing is, when they talked about the 381 million to upgrade equipment, infrastructure and facilities, they did say such as Hospital Pontian. So we are talking about in the context of a hospital, which seems to be an overlap, as
with
you said,
with
the first allocation.
Yeah. And I suppose I can see, right? I mean, if you're saying that it's for the construction upgrading of hospitals, then it's perhaps hospital services for patients. But then if you're talking about infrastructure and facilities, it might even be things like the toilets or the parking lots. Or the walkways, which are important as well.
Right. Okay. And one more to add is a 5 million ringgit allocation for mobile clinics in rural areas, especially for Orang Asli. So right now, let's turn to Dr. Kor for his comments on these few allocations.
The first one is the long overdue emphasis on infrastructure development and maintenance. Approximately 1.6 billion ringgit is allocated to the maintenance and development and upgrades of hospitals, of which we've got 390 million ringgit to upgrade the clinic kesihatan and dental clinics and hospital quarters. The 319 million, I think, is a very good allocation because it will help improve the living conditions of doctors and nurses, especially those living in rural areas. So I think infrastructure development and maintenance, very overdue. The absent part of it, of the discussion for infrastructure development, is that there's not yet any discussion about a predictable contract with predictable contractors with more transparency for performance criteria. So we don't know who these contracts are going to, and we don't know what kind of criteria we're going to measure them against.
Ooh, contracts and contractors. I'm so glad he mentioned that. Yes. But I'm not going to derail your discussion. Just I know we've got quite a few points to get through. And the next one is something of particular interest to me. At the Health and Living event, junior event, back on the 5th of October, I hosted or moderated this panel on vaccinations. And Dr. Musa there made a very, very bold statement about how he was certain that the pneumococcal vaccine was going to be included in this year's national immunization.
He practically staked his career on it.
did. I nearly stood on my chair and cheered for the man. And here we have an initial allocation of 60 million ringgit to kickstart the pneumococcal vaccination for children. And it's supposed to be part of our national immunisation plan. Yes.
Right. Yes. But so here is where Pediatrician and Immunise for Life Chairman Dr. Zulkifli Ismail has commented that 60 million ringgit actually isn't enough to vaccinate all of the 450,000 birth cohort. And the cost of refrigeration required to hold these single dose vials as well.
I mean, yeah, 60 million, good place to start. But the, you know, how sustainable or how adequate will this be?
Perhaps what they're looking at is to see whether there will be a reduction in deaths caused by the pneumococcal virus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So let's hear from Dr. Kaur again for his comments on the vaccination.
I think it's great for many reasons. Firstly, it's pro-vaccine. Secondly, it's pro-science. Thirdly, it will have herd immunity also for adults. All these things are good in and of itself. The challenges for us to be mindful are two. The first one is that we need to be considering what about future funding, meaning in 2021 and onwards, are we going to have at least 60 million ringgit for pneumococcal vaccines as well? And secondly, obviously, we need to consider other vaccine-preventable diseases. This is against the backdrop of more people being anti-vaccine this day, so perhaps some portion of it will go towards vaccine education.
So moving on to the next point again, we also asked Dr. Kaur to comment on the My Salam Income Replacement Program, which will now be expanded to include 9 more illnesses, and for those aged up to 65 years old and those in the M40 income bracket.
This is welcome news, and congratulations to the government for this. The absent discussion is obviously about the unequal and frankly very opaque contract with Great Eastern in terms of disbursement. At the moment, some evidence shows that Great Eastern's disbursements in terms of the insurance claims are very paltry, 5 to 10%. Now, I don't have the actual numbers, but mostly that's because they're not transparent. So I think the government can do better in terms of clarifying the relationship and contract terms between Great Eastern and the government.
I think it's also worth pointing out at this point that polio was one of the illnesses added into the scheme, right? Mm-hmm. And I had to do a quick double take and check whether it was budget 2020 or 2018. What are we doing?
Polio has been eradicated from Malaysia.
And we're proud of the status as well, right? Yes. So by all intents and purposes, there should be no space for polio as a critical illness under My Salam.
Mm. And also, I mean, to be fair, there's not much, there are not enough details yet on what these additional 9 critical illnesses are. It's just something that we've picked up in some of the news reports that mention polio is one of them to be added in. Terminal illnesses are another. But that, again,
how is that?
It's very vague.
Yeah, too vague. And we need to wait. The My Salam website was not yet updated with what these additional illnesses are to be. But already some doctors have begun commenting to the media that it doesn't make sense to include polio.
I would absolutely concur. The other thing that was mentioned, of course, was the PKA B40 screening program. That created quite a few ripples as well.
It's expanded from age 55, or rather lowered to age 40 plus, and I think this is a good expansion as well. But the uptake remains very low for two reasons. The citizens aren't really aware of the benefits of PKA B40, and private GPs aren't really supportive of it. Now, without private GPs, we cannot make this a successful test case for any future public-private partnerships. So some discussion about how much the government would pay private GPs in order to have this consultations and screenings, I think is also overdue.
I remember earlier this year when the health minister mentioned that, you know, the PKA B40 was being kind of explained to the people. He did say that it was very much about being able to help kind of doctors catch NCDs, non-communicable diseases, early on. That was the reason why this program was open to this particular age group.
So that we can prevent them from worsening, from getting into complications.
So lowering the age limit to, rather the age bracket to 40 is fantastic. But you know, if you have a look, and I don't want to sound like a wet blanket, but it will be something that we need to look at in years to come as well, because Malaysians are already, we've got high risk factors when it comes to NCDs. I think 60% of Malaysians by the age of 18 already have risk factors for NCDs. And in years to come, we might need to lower that age limit to to 20s and 30s, perhaps.
Yeah, and, you know, as Dr. Kaur points out, you know, if we have a low take up, if we have a good program, but the take-up is low, we need to be looking seriously at the whether it's logistical reasons. Yep. What are the barriers to the take-up?
Yeah. The other bit of news that has been simmering in the health news digests is the fact that, about the procurement of medicines, right? Mm, so then yes. There is now an announcement that the government will centralize and combine the tender and procurement of 500 million ringgit worth of medicines across Ministry of Health, Ministry of Defence and University Hospitals, which fall under Ministry of Education.
Yes, that's right.
To generate savings from bulk purchase. Mm. And Dr. Koh explained what this means.
Well, at the moment, the Ministry of Health procures approximately 3.2 if I recall, billion ringgit worth of medicines per year. And the Ministry of Health receives something like 85-90% of the total government allocation. There are two more ministries that procure medicines. The Ministry of Education runs the university hospitals, of which there are at least four big ones, University Malaya Medical Center, Hospital University Kebangsaan, or Chancellor Tunku Mukriz, HUSM in Kelantan, and the Hospital UITM and Hospital Putra as well in Serdang and Shah Alam respectively. Now, the third ministry is the Ministry of Defence, with their defence hospitals, for example, in Lumut as well as in Jalan Semara in Kuala Lumpur. Now, the three ministries would procure medicines separately. Because of the Ministry of Health size, they can procure with some economies of scale. Mm-hmm. But the procurement is done at the university hospital individual level, as well as the Ministry of Defence individual level. So pooling it will have some economies of scale, also allow us better purchasing power and bargaining power with various pharmaceuticals, both inside and outside of Malaysia. So that's the reason why they want to have pool procurement. Now, pool procurement, I think, will give you negotiating power. But there are a few other aspects that might need to be there. For example, the use of health economics, which is still nascent in Malaysia. We don't use economic values in terms of determining which medicine to procure and what to procure. Mm-hmm. The second thing is we don't have a really clear generics policy. There is one in the National Medicines Policy, but it remains to be seen whether or not it's implemented in Malaysia. Other than the economies of scale and the use of health technology assessments and the use of a clear generics policy, I think this is an opportunity for Malaysia's generic sector and local pharma manufacturers to have a greater say. We have to have some self-sufficiency in case of any disruptions in global supply chains, in any global trade war between America and China, which could drag in other countries as well. Mm-hmm. So medicines, self-sufficiency is something that Malaysia could look at, and some pool procurement will give us some bargaining power in stimulating the growth of Malaysia's industrial capacity in pharmaceuticals.
So there was also specific mention that the EPF withdrawals and income tax relief would include fertility treatment.
That was an interesting one.
Yeah, I have my thoughts about this, but we know, of course, we'll let Dr. Koh, who's the expert, weigh in on this and other items in the budget related to health in the context of larger social issues.
I think that's good news for the social sector as well as the intersects with health. EPF is now allowing withdrawals for fertility treatment, and maternity leave is now upgraded from 60 days to 90 days. There are other questions for us to consider. The large-scale social shifts, why are people having babies later? They're having fewer babies. They're also marrying later. Not that it's really related to health, but I think that there are larger issues at play over here. And in terms of maternity leave, the full pay, whether or not they're having maternity leave for full pay, whether or not they will return to their existing roles, and whether or not there will be some movements surrounding paternity leave at the moment, which is still a very low 7 days.
Hmm. So, as you mentioned, you have some thoughts about the fertility treatment being included. Hmm. And the Federation of Private Medical Practitioners Associations has also had their comment on the issue. They questioned this allocation because they said that falling birth rates is an economic issue, not one of sterility.
And I would have to kind of squarely agree with that, right? Mm. And it's not going to be a popular or populist view either. But, you know, having babies while is being encouraged by the government, there needs to be space for these babies to come into society. Mm-hmm. Parents need to be able to look after them. Socioeconomic indicators at the moment are not very good for children coming into being in Malaysia. Where is the education system? Where are the support systems? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was also no specific allocations to address some of the other major disease trends that are burdening our population. So if you look at mental health or prevention of NCDs that we were talking about earlier. So Dr. Kaur also offered his thoughts on this and other missed opportunities in the budget.
In fairness to the Ministry of Finance and Health, it's possibly buried in the nitty-gritty, and it's not really highly visible to you or I because it's all buried there in that 200-page document that we have come up with. So it's not so easily visible to the public. This is in fairness to both the ministries. I have always been wondering about the decision-making privileges between Ministry of Health and Finance, in a sense that Ministry of Health is staffed with a lot of very competent technocrats. So why is it that the Ministry of Finance is taking the lead in making these decisions about what to allocate and then publicizing these decisions about what to allocate as well? In essence, what I propose is that the Ministry of Health be given, for example, a lump sum. It could be pegged to GDP, it could be pegged to revenue, it could be pegged to tax basis and so on and so forth, but guaranteeing a lump sum and allowing the Ministry of Health, not Finance, to determine where the spending would go. Because then we will be able to prevent the second problem, the deprioritization of less glamorous and less visible priorities. What I mean to say is preventive care is always going to be less glamorous, less sexy, less visible compared to curative care. So then these blind spots, whenever you're giving the Ministry of Health the decision privileges, could be minimized because they have a little bit more subject matter expertise compared to people in the Ministry of Finance. So having said that, let's talk about a few more. Mental health is a missed opportunity. Prevention of NCDs is a second missed opportunity. A third, fourth, and fifth missed opportunity is, firstly, sustainable financing. There is no move within the budget this year to plan for a move towards more sustainable financing because if we're only relying on tax-based financing for our health system and not moving to alternative sources or hybrid sources of financing, and we don't begin in 2020, it might be too late in 2021 and onwards. So I think that's a third missed opportunity, especially when it comes to stimulating the uptake of insurance, health and medical insurance. The fourth missed opportunity, in my opinion, is old age care. There is a role for EPF over here, not only in the withdrawal for fertility treatment, but in a few other withdrawals for education and housing. But what about EPF's role in old age care? And as we consider silver tsunami, that Malaysia will be an aged country as early as 2035, 15 years from now, we need long-term measures starting this year or next year to retool our society and financing towards old age care. And fifthly and finally, multi-year reform. We've always talked, we as in society, civil society, doctors, Ministry of Health itself, have spoken about multi-year reform. And yet there is no allocation within budget this year because the budget is necessarily short-term. It's looking at only 1 year when it should be looking at multi-year reform.
So we also asked Dr. Kaur how we monitor these allocations. How do we know that the money is going where it should go?
Unfortunately, the answer relies on existing mechanisms. You've touched upon a subject which is very under-discussed in a sense that every time we talk about budget, Malaysia in health and otherwise only talks about how much money we put in, meaning the input. We hardly talk about output, meaning for the 30 billion ringgit, how many doctors are we employing? And we hardly talk about outcomes. What are these doctors doing to reduce the rates of diabetes, to increase the rates of successful surgeries and so on? So the absent conversation is always about outputs and outcomes because it's so easy to be distracted by talking about inputs. At the moment, the Auditor General will produce a report, but the Auditor General goes in not regularly in all the different organizations within for the Ministry of Health because they are understaffed in a bureaucracy that is quite large and through no fault of their own. Audit departments are generally understaffed in any organization that has ever worked in. The second way that we hold the government accountable is through civil society. The third way is through the opposition parties. And the fourth way is through media. And I ranked them in random order, not saying that one is more important than the other. But these four components, I guess, say the Auditor General, opposition parties, the media, civil societies and citizens will hold an important role in holding the government accountable between October this year and October next year in the next budget sitting. But what we perhaps need is a long overdue national conversation, beginning with doctors themselves and then going on to the Ministry of Health. A discussion about performance metrics. in two ways, financial performance and, operational performance. In financial performance, a lot of this technology exists for us to put our budget spending on blockchain or in public domain, for example, that the individual citizen will be able to hold the government accountable for their budgetary spending. This will have the added benefits of reducing corruption, increasing transparency, increasing trust in the government. So transparent budgetary performance or financial performance is one way that we can enhance the accountability and oversight of the government. The second one is equally important, which is what is the performance metric, operational performance of a hospital? Mm-hmm. So example, Hospital Taiping, they should feel confident about publicizing how many patients they see a year, which they do. How many patients are admitted, which they do. What they don't publish is how many patients pass away in Hospital Taiping, stratified by department. For example, in Department of Medicine and the Department of ONG, this is the mortality rate, this is the case rates of asthma, this is our length of stay, and so on. All this information about performance is not easily available, but that would help us hold the government accountable for the outcomes of the money that we allocate to the Ministry of Health, for example.
Mm, and finally, Dr. Koh offered his perspective on the macroeconomic aspects of the overall budget.
As an overall spending, we've reduced. In 2019, we were spending 314 billion ringgit. And in 2020, we are spending 299 billion ringgit only. Therefore, this is a reduction of 5% versus last year, or 15 billion ringgit versus last year. This is, in my opinion, welcome, because this is responsible. We're not taking much additional new debt. This is not a populist budget. This is a very realistic budget. So I think the government deserves some congratulations for appropriate financial stewardship of our country. In terms of how it impacts the Ministry of Health, is that if the tax revenue for Malaysia continues to drop year on year, then the allocations for the Ministry of Health could drop from 30 billion next year to whatever billion in 2021. Now, despite the decrease 2020 versus 2019, the Ministry of Health allocations have increased 6.7% or 1.9 billion ringgit in absolute terms. And I think this is not something that the Ministry of Health should get complacent about. Our tax revenue, if it continues to drop, and one hopes it doesn't, but we should be prepared for a rainy day, so to speak, then it becomes more imperative for the Ministry of Health to think about sustainable long-term financing and moving away from a purely tax-based financing system.
So that was Dr. Koh Swee King, Senior Fellow for Health Systems and Policies, University of Malaya, and he's been weighing in on several items of the Budget 2020's health allocations. Mm-hmm. A lot of things to think about there, and whether mm-hmm. this is really a budget that serves the long-term healthcare needs of the Malaysian population. Mm-hmm. If Minister of Finance Lim Guan Eng was saying that these are allocations to intensify preventive measures, yeah. I feel like it kind of missed the mark there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel we need another show on this.
Yes.
Deep dive into it.
Okay, so Mitra is holding me to a lot. We will be planning some follow-ups for the Health and Living show, I'm sure.
Yes.
And that's all the time that we have for today's show. Look us up on Facebook. Our Facebook page is BFM The Bigger Picture if you would like to drop us a message. And if you missed any part of the show, you can download the podcast on bfm.my /Daily Digest on our BFM app or on Spotify. Stay tuned, because after the 3 p.m. news on Front Row, Shamila Gunnison will be speaking to three conservators from the Islamic Arts Museum Malaysia about conservation in museums.
Very nice.
And that's all from us at the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.